As I'm just walking in here, just once again, not having a clue what I'm going to talk about. I said I do this every week. I should be a nervous wreck by now. Imagine facing about 300 people here, and apparently about 25,000 people listen to this talk on the internet. And there you are, no preparation, not knowing what you're going to do. For the title of the talk, I don't obviously don't get nervous because I just enjoy myself, and that's perhaps one of the answers to, I think, three or four suggestions for this evening's talk. One of the first suggestions was on the meaning of life, but I talked about that before, and you all know the meaning of life. Well, perhaps you don't. Maybe I'll talk about it again. There was also that somebody was asking about their, how should a Buddhist deal with animals who are very sick? Should they be put down? I talked about that before, but I will mention that in passing. Another person asked about separation. And there was an old request. I haven't actually been talked about this, about giving a talk about procrastination. I got that request about 2 months ago, and I've been putting off giving a talk about procrastination. And anyway, why not? Because one of my favorite sayings is never do today what you can put off until tomorrow. I'm actually, quite in line with procrastination. And sometimes when you think about procrastination, that must be the opposite to anti-crastination. And I think I like anti-crastinating rather than procrastinating. But whatever crastination means, that sometimes why are we so hard upon ourselves? What do we actually mean by procrastination anyway? I mean, we're not doing something. Why aren't we doing it? Because we think maybe it's not really worthwhile doing, and maybe not worthwhile doing yet. But anyway, just why do we do all of these things? We're compulsive doers, control freaks, perfectionists. Again, one of the sayings, and I get into trouble for this, but I think it's a good saying to modern society. When you go home in the evening, and because you've rushed here to come and meditate, listen to the talk, and you see all those dirty dishes in the sink which need washing, always compare the dirty dishes in the sink with the number of dishes which are already cleaned and stacked up. If the ones already clean and stacked up are in the majority, you are ahead. So just, watch a movie, go to bed, don't worry about it. But why is it that we look at the dirty dishes and we have to clean them up? That compulsive doing and perfecting everything, that's one of the problems why people have a trouble with procrastinating. There's nothing wrong with procrastination. And I think we should have a pro-procrastination society, and I'll be their president. But also, that saying, why do today what you can put off until tomorrow, is a very good saying. We're all so stressed out. We do too much. And what sort of quality of life is that? Do you really? You think that's the meaning of life? Just getting things done? And getting like a house which is perfect so when neighbors come in you don't feel embarrassed? Or just, having all the dishes clean, all the carpets swept, all the gutters clean, or whatever else. Gee, that sometimes that, I think I've been in Serpentine Monastery now for 24 years, when we even started the place. And a long time ago, people would say, "Have you finished building the monastery yet?" And I got fed up with answering because the answer is no, we're still building. We're building this afternoon. When is the monastery finished being built? Never. And this is one of the wonderful things. When is your house finished being renovated? Never. When is the garden finished being perfected? Never. When do you finish learning things about life? Never. When will you be the perfect meditator? Never. Because if you think you are, then you're missing the point. And the point is, this life is always going to be in change. And even the sort of the building is falling down, you just heard it there. So the point is that things are always in flux and always in change. And until we actually learn how to understand life and be at peace with it and accept it. Sometimes that we work too hard trying to change it, trying to make it into some ideal of what life is meant to be. And basically that this is what we learn not to do when we practice, say, meditation. Now, when we teach meditation, especially in monasteries or retreats, when we really go to the heart of it, we say, just be where you are. Be more fully where you are. Stop going somewhere. Stop changing things. Let go. Be still. Be at peace with things. Open the door of your heart to things as they actually are right now. It's quite a radical teaching. In fact, the most 100% intense procrastination you could ever do is to sit down and meditate. You're putting everything off. You're putting your life away, all your worries and concerns away. You're just putting everything sort of on the back burner for half an hour, and you deserve that. And it's worthwhile doing. You really do put it off, unless you have to do something. That's why I say, don't do today what you can put off until tomorrow. If it's not really worthwhile doing now, then don't do it. Why do we do so many things? And sometimes you can see the result of doing so many things. Yeah, you can have big achievements in life and degrees and big houses, but what sort of person lives in those houses? What sort of person has got that degree? I know, are you really happy inside? Really, the degree should actually be inside. That's why the Nobel Peace Prize should go to monks and nuns. You know, because we actually know what peace is. And that is a noble type of peace, not some of these other stuff which we hear about. Or, you know, to yourself when you get into deep meditation, we can give you a Nobel Peace Prize. But the thing is, we get Nobel Activity Prizes, what most people do. They're always doing things, they're getting frantic. And you know what it's like when there's a person who's really frantic? It upsets everybody around them. Sometimes, you ask people, why do you go to the nuns' monastery? If you want to go to a beautiful park, why do you go to King's Park? It's much closer. Why do you go to the monks' monastery and feed them? Gee, they're old enough to cook for themselves. Okay, when you've got kids, you feed them. But why are you feeding these grown-up monks? Why do people go to these places? And I've often asked them that. Why do they go to these places? And they say they go there because they feel peaceful. And sometimes being around a peaceful person makes us feel peaceful. It makes us touch the meaning of life. Just talking with someone who has been to our monastery down at Serpentine just last week, and they went to meditate for a few minutes in our meditation hall. It's always open there for people to meditate. And they say it's a nice peaceful hall, and it is. It's got an atmosphere built up over 24 years of quiet people meditating there. And it has some great monks and nuns who sat in that meditation hall over 24 years. It's got atmosphere. What I found, I don't know how this works, what the physics of it is, but you're sensitive enough to that some places you go in this world and very still and peaceful. You just go in there and it's easy to meditate. You know, what has actually happened is that so much good and deep meditation has happened in those areas that it creates an atmosphere that pulls you into that stillness, into that peace, into that calmness. And there's a few other places where you go, you know, that many of you go to these pilgrimages in India, or you go to some of these really holy monasteries in Thailand. You go in places where these other great beings have actually sat down and meditated. And I'm not sure why it is. Even I feel that. It gets so peaceful and calm. Areas do have a way of stopping you. All those busyness and things and problems in your life, all those things which need to be done, in those places of calm and stillness, they don't feel they need to be done anymore. Your whole priorities change. And instead of having to do something, which is why you feel guilty about procrastinating, you feel, no, I'm not going to do it. I'll do it later on. One of the great stories in that book of opening the door of your heart, and I haven't said this for a long time, it's a good story because it's coming up to our Rains retreat in 2 or 3 weeks' time. Rains retreat, you know, you'll notice here, because the monks and nuns, we don't come up to give talks most of the time. I will actually break the rule and come and give a couple of talks the beginning of August and end of October, but usually we'd stay in our monastery. And this is a tradition where the monks stop travelling and we stop doing things. And in this particular story, there was this monk in South Thailand. He was building his hall, this big meditation Dhamma hall in his monastery. And it got to the rains retreat time. So he sent all the workers home. He wanted a bit of peace and quiet in his monastery for those 3 months so they could meditate and maybe study. So all the builders went home. And during that retreat, a visitor came. They talked to this abbot and looked at this hall with no windows and no roof and rubbish all over the floor and said, "Oh, when is your building going to be complete? When is it going to be finished?" And the monk replied, "It is finished." "It is finished," he said. "How can you say that?" said the visitor. "Are you going to leave it like this? Is it some sort of like modern Thai art you have no windows or roof on?" "What do you mean it's finished?" he said. And this monk replied, "What's done is finished." And he went off to meditate then. And I thought, wow, that's very profound. What's done is finished. So the next time that you're washing the dishes and it's time to meditate, it doesn't matter. What's done is finished. You can go off and meditate. Otherwise, however are you going to find any peace in your life? What he was meaning there, he gave peace a higher priority than getting his building completed. And he said, "Well, look, when is it going to be finished anyway? You know, when actually do we complete things? And actually, the only time we ever really complete things, and it's only physically, is when you're dead. It's the only time you get all your business done. Or rather, what happens, you find out it didn't really need to get done anyway. All those unfinished ends which you had, so what?" So a lot of times that our compulsion to do things is coming from a lot of stupidity. And it's not benign stupidity that really affects us and hurts us as we give completing our tasks a higher priority than being peaceful, being happy, and sharing time, say, with our family. The ability to say, "No, I'm going to put this off and do something more important," is understanding what the meaning of life actually is. I did write a little piece for a conference I'm going to be going to in November and send it off way ahead of time, just because I felt inspired. And it was supposed to be the purpose of life. And in that little essay, I was writing on a hierarchy of purposes and how a lot of suffering and problems in life comes from not having the right hierarchy. Yeah, there's many meanings of life, but what's the most important meaning? What's the main purpose? And as long as you focus on what is the most important purpose of your life and give that priority, and the lesser purposes in life, you know, second in the priority list, then you have a very wise life. Now, what is really important? Health, happiness? Surely that's more important than sort of keeping your job or becoming rich or becoming popular. So sometimes I really wonder, why do people wreck their health? You know, just because of seeking the job, or keeping the job even though it's causing a lot of, you know, heartache, you know, literally, you know, in the physical body and also the mental health. What are you doing that for? What's really important in life? Get your priorities right, for goodness sake. And sometimes people keep on working when they're sick, and they just end up in an early grave. Is that really what the purpose of life is? So we have to get our priorities right. That's why that you've heard me say here that when relationships, husbands and wives, parents and children, why do we have arguments? Because we give being right more priority than being loving and caring and compassionate and forgiving. I don't know why that is in our life, that we think being right is more important than these other things. Perhaps it's because of this ego business and the sense of self is pride. It just makes these priorities go the opposite way around. It's more important in life. You know, not that you're right, but you have a happy time, a peaceful time together. You know, that's why, you know, that old joke, you don't, if you're in a marriage and if you are wrong, you confess it. If you're right, you shut up. And that way that you never upset anybody. But whatever it is, to make sure that you have the right priority in a relationship. What's the most important? And being right should be low importance than being loving, being kind, being forgiving, being caring. So it's the same in a monastery. You know, for an easy life, you know, it's when you just agree with the other monks. Even they say stupid things. Oh, that's all right by me. And they don't have any arguments that way. And people see the truth for themselves afterway, in the long term. So you don't have to be the one who puts them right, who turns them, challenges their mistakes. You know what it's like when people are just so picky, they're always disagreeing with you. And I don't know, that sometimes that when you see people who've been married a long time, the way they speak to each other, you think, oh, there's two really nice people. Why do they speak to each other like that? And got into these bad habits, and the priorities in life are all messed up. Their meaning, the purpose, has all been jumbled up. So we have hierarchy of purposes. I think the highest purpose is peace, happiness, contentment, fulfillment. So make sure that that's the most important thing in your life. Go for that first of all. And then the other things come secondary to your happiness and health. It's more important to spend time with your family. Years ago, a story comes to my mind. There was one of the early pioneers of our Buddhist society, one of the three or four people who went all the way to Thailand to invite our Western monks to come to Perth. And he left from here and went over, I think, first to, I was to New Zealand, I think. He was working in the hospitality industry in hotels. He had a really cushy job, you know, with a free apartment in this resort hotel somewhere in New Zealand. But being a very devout Buddhist, there was a Thai monk who was visiting there. And because of some problems there, the Thai monk, because he couldn't speak good English, had an attendant with him. And the attendant couldn't get a flight to New Zealand or had to go back to Thailand. And so this monk was on his own. Okay, while he was in New Zealand. But on the journey back to Thailand, he was traveling by himself. And not being able to speak English is a big trouble. Actually, that same monk, Ajahn Yanadamo, told me this story. He took him to the airport, the old airport in Bangkok, some years ago. And they checked him in. And because he couldn't read the English on the boarding pass, they took him actually, Ajahn Yala took him to the where the departure gate was. He was about to sort of to say goodbye. And he found actually, instead of actually coming to Australia, they printed a boarding pass sending him to Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. I don't know how this happens, but it can happen. And this poor monk, he was a Thai monk who couldn't speak any English. You can imagine what would have happened. He'd have shown the boarding pass, oh, over there, sir, and they just pointed the way. And he would end up in Saudi Arabia. And they don't like Buddhist monks in Saudi Arabia. So it's very lucky that Ajahn Yala saw the boarding pass just in time. But anyway, so you can see the importance of having these attendants sometimes, especially if you cannot speak English. And so they've had an attendant. So this Thai man, he asked his boss, look, this is a Thai monk, you know, I really respect him. Can I take a few days off just to send him to Thailand? You know, I'll pay the airfare and I'll be back in about 4 or 5 days' time. The boss said, no, you can't go. It's a busy time. He said, now, look, this is really important to me. I don't ask very much. I need to sort of accompany this monk, you know, from Auckland back over to Bangkok. It won't take me long. No, you can't, said the boss. Really? Said this Thai man. Certainly. Okay, I resign. And he just gave up his job. It was more important for him, actually, to look after this, you know, Thai monk than to keep his job. And when he told his girlfriend went ballistic. How can you give up this wonderful job? You can't get these jobs easy. You got a nice apartment as well. You're stupid. Because it was like a Caucasian girlfriend, wasn't interested into Buddhism at all. But he made his decision. He took that Thai monk back to Thailand, had a few extra days in Thailand because he didn't have a job. When he came back, I think with 24 hours, he got another job with a bigger apartment and this time with a car. His girlfriend was very impressed. So that's why you should always look after monks. It's always good karma, and nuns as well. But the nice thing about that story, that man had his priorities right. It was really important in life. And he was willing actually to sacrifice the lower priorities for what had most meaning for him. As many of you do, when you really, like you're sick or dying, what is most important to you? Remember that because you understand what the meaning of life is. That life has many meanings, a hierarchy of purposes. And sometimes we choose the lower purposes at the expense of the higher ones. And that's where we get into trouble and suffering in life. And afterwards, what did we do that for? It wasn't all that important after all. And so that gives us an understanding of what the meaning of life is. Actually, how we make up that hierarchy of purposes. You know, you can use your reflection, use your meditation to look deeply what's most important in life, what's medium importance, what's of less importance. Understand that. See the big picture. Don't look at the importance of, you know, the tasks today. Please look at the big picture, because sometimes when people are just focused just on the demands of, you know, today, they miss that big picture. One of the good things about coming to a place like this is you can expand and to see those big pictures. And that's actually why we do a bit of meditation to find that peace, to reconnect with what's most important in life. That's why I say that people go to those places like our monastery, and just such peaceful places, and say, wow, this is what our meaning is. This is what I've been looking for. This is what really means something to me. Things have different values. And sometimes our value lists sort of is all wrong. You know, just having your football team win again on the weekend, that's not that important. That's lower in the list of values. What's more important is having a peaceful, happy day. So if your wife comes along and says, look, darling, can you please take me to the shops instead of watching the footy? Please drive her to the shops. You can always listen to the footy on the radio. We have like a happier time that way. Because, you know, you're having no arguments. So whatever it is, if you remember what the most important purposes are and don't go for the lesser purposes, you understand how we create the meaning of life. And you'll always find you very, very successful and very, very, very happy. But that meaning of life, you know, we have to get those perspectives and understandings. And a lot of times that people, what I was saying earlier, in the meditation, we don't know about that peace which is born of freedom. That's the biggest meaning of the life for me anyway, to be free. I don't mean free means you can't enjoy each other's company. I don't mean free means you don't have any responsibilities. But, you know, to me, that's all that freedom is, being able just to adapt, to change, just to accommodate to whatever's happening, but keeping the underlying meaning of freedom and peace there. Saying at the beginning when we're doing the meditation, just about how many of us are tethered to the past or tethered to the future or tethered to thought. And we lose the meaning of life, the peace and the freedom to enjoy our friends and relations in the moment. I do remember just when I, about 10 years ago, when I went to visit where I was born. And I had a free morning and just had a walk to the places where I grew up. And I could, being in London, the buildings in London don't change. Actually, I noticed all the pubs where I used to go were still there, but many of the churches had disappeared. It was very interesting just to see what type of buildings remain and what type of buildings are no longer in use. So you can understand what the predominant religion in London is. But all those places where I grew up, you could see the buildings were the same, but there was something missing. The time had moved on, the people had gone. Those moments would never be able to be captured again. It was actually a defining moment for me because in the fantasies, in the dreams, in the memories, the things were always the same. But I faced with the reality of a building where I used to live, but now with different inhabitants. In a school where I used to play, but now completely different children. And even visiting my last time, visiting my mother, who, as I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, is now suffering from dementia, who could hardly recognize me. You look to that, and is that my mother, or is that another person? It was more the second option, another person, because the connection with the past had been mostly severed. It's so fascinating to be able to sever that past and to free, but still be kind. Sometimes that our connection between the part with the past serves only to limit us, to stop us growing in the present. And a lot of those old memories, those old pains, those old arguments, you think, gee, why can't we move on? It's interesting why people don't move on. Again, because their meanings are just skewed. The hierarchy of purposes is not really understood. They think that we have to deal with that past, that we have to remember, we have to right the wrongs. You don't have to be the one who rights the wrongs. Fortunately, no matter what religion you are, and many people here aren't Buddhists, and they may be Christians, or some people listen to these talks, they're Muslims. They're not allowed to come here, but they can always open up the webpage on the internet. It's one of the wonderful things about putting these things on such a free media where religious boundaries can't go. And so when people look at the past, and all religions always realize that somehow or other the rights will be the rights and the wrongs will be balanced. There is some sort of cosmic justice somewhere. They always say that it's like an Allah or a God or a Jehovah will right those wrongs. In Buddhism, we say it's karma will just balance things. But the nice thing about that is you don't have to be the one who does it. It's a natural process. It'll work out by itself. What goes around comes around. If someone has misused you, abused you, ill-treated you, you don't have to be the one who seeks justice, because justice is natural, automatic. In spite of what you do or you don't do, justice happens. It's a very comforting thing in one sense, because it means that you have the opportunity to let go of that business. You don't need to be the executioner. You don't need to be the prosecutor. You don't need to do anything. You can completely let go and forgive, understanding that whatever karma they did will come back to them. It's a beautiful little teaching, because it gives you the opportunity to let go of your past, to forgive and move on. It's a great little thing because it means you don't tether yourself to the past. And a lot of times people find their meaning and their place in the past. As I said, when I visited those old haunts when I grew up, and I realized those places had changed. The outside was the same, but the internal part of it, the most important part of it, was completely different. It meant that no longer would I identify myself as being a Londoner, or even being English. These days it's great, you know how much I travel, and sometimes I just really don't know where I belong. This is why, and this is how I feel whenever I go traveling. You go traveling to, say, Thailand, and that's where I spent 9 years of my life and got so many friends and good memories there. So every time I land in, actually, it's a different airport now, but every time I used to land in the old airport, I thought, wow, I'm coming home. See all those beautiful Buddhist temples where I used to hang out. Wow, coming home. And then from Thailand, I'd usually take the next trip maybe to England. And then as you were coming into Heathrow, you could see these little old pubs, you know, the quaint old English pubs, which to me defined that country. And I thought, wow, I'm coming home again. Can't go in them anymore. It's a bit of a shame, but never mind. I can look out the outside. And then you sort of go to another place, like I spent a lot of time in Singapore now. You land in Changi Airport and then you go along the, the Marine Coast Drive, the East Coast Parkway or something, ECP. You go down there to visit your friends, say, oh, I'm coming home again now. Somebody go to KL, you're coming home again now. And then eventually you come back to Perth and you're coming on in the aircraft and you can see the city through the window. Oh, I'm coming home again. And now, a few times, I've been to Sri Lanka. And so, you know, Sri Lanka is some of the home of Theravada Buddhism. Oh, I'm coming home again to see all these beautiful monks and temples and pagodas. So sometimes I don't know where I belong, which is my home. Isn't it wonderful not to be tethered to a place? And not to think that you're English or you're Australian or you're Sri Lankan. It's great whenever there's a cricket match on. It means I can support any side. I usually wait till about half time or the lunch interval in cricket and find out who's winning and then support them. So that way you've got more chance to be on the winning side. Doesn't that make sense? It's the same within Perth here. You've got the two footy teams, the Dockers south of the river, the Eagles north of the river. Yeah, I come in this centre here. Now I'm north of the river. When I'm in Serpentine, I'm south of the river. So I can support both teams. The point being here is when you don't tether yourself to the past or to your places where you were born, you're free. You actually, as I was saying last week, you've disconnected, you let go of something which limits you. And then you can be far freer. In our modern world anyway, just what does it mean to be Australian, Sri Lankan, to be Burmese, to be English, Scottish, Irish, Welsh? Whenever you go across those borders, I never see lines marked on those borders. See, people who live on those borders, they go backwards and forwards exactly the same on either side. Why do we tether ourselves to these boundaries which really just make no sense? Even the boundaries between religion. Do you tether yourself to being a Buddhist or a Christian or a Muslim? You can see just how much problems that creates in our world. Just yesterday afternoon, I was had a nice hour's chat with one of my mates, Rabbi Bernstein. Moshe Bernstein. He used to be the chaplain of Carmel School a few years ago. And he came along to talk about something or other. And he made a very wonderful point because he's one of the two or three teachers in Australia of the Kabbalah, which is a Jewish mystical tradition. And we were comparing some notes about what he has in that tradition, what we have in Buddhism. He said, you know, there's something which he found really so similar to the Anapanasati, the breath meditation of Buddhism. And we're just talking to think that because Buddhism was the earlier tradition, that actually, well, earlier than the Kabbalah anyway, do you think that actually came from Buddhism into that tradition, or did people actually find these things out simultaneously? Well, basically, that there's a possibility that, you know, the Buddhist tradition did go to that part of the world, but if it didn't, people will still find these things out by themselves, because this is natural that when you, say, follow the breath and you meditate, you become peaceful and calm. When you're compassionate and kind, it creates happiness in this world. When you let go of the past and you don't worry about the future, it gives you a sense of freedom and ability of being in power. It doesn't matter whether you're a Buddhist or wherever you are. These are natural laws. The law of gravity just applies whether you're in Burma, Australia, Thailand, or in the Islamic world, whatever. It's a constant natural law which applies all over the place. And I think that these spiritual laws are also common. Sometimes you just need to go inside. And Rabbi Bernstein was saying that, you know, he was part of the Jewish mystical tradition. And Buddhism is mostly mystical, not always. You get the scholar monks, you get the philosophers and the social workers. But the sort of tradition you have here, because we come from the forest tradition, all meditators, this is, if anything, the Buddhist mystical tradition. You go to the Islamic Sufi tradition, which was their mystical tradition. It's very interesting as a monk, when you go to the mystical traditions of all these great religions, you find there's so much in common. It's amazing. And also very reassuring. The nature of the human mind, the nature of peace, the nature of compassion. It's the same no matter where you come from, what religion, what race, what gender, what sexual orientation. Which is, does give a universality to the mystical tradition. It gives it higher meaning. And the reason it has that deeper meaning, it is because it's not tethered to anything. It's not tethered to a race, to a religion, to a gender, or anything. It's free. What a wonderful thing that is, to know that when you do untether yourselves to things, it's not as if you're lost without sort of a rudder, but you're actually more free, you come closer to the truth, the real meaning of things, the true peace, and thereby you understand what we're all doing here, what the real meaning of life is. So when we're flowing through life, you know, we do let go of the past, but we also don't tether ourselves, as I said in the meditation, to throw out a line to the future. I don't know why people worry so much about what's going to happen next. There's such a lot of worry about global warming. When I was growing up, there was a lot of worry about a nuclear war. Don't know if it happens. You've got nothing to worry about. We're all dead. If it doesn't happen, you've got nothing to worry about. It never happened. A lot of times, why do people worry about the future so much? And a lot of times that you see it's completely dysfunctional. It's just a wrong way of thinking about things. Sure, it's a problem. But instead of worrying about it, either do something about it or just leave it alone. But stop worrying. Worrying is this stupid option. That's one of the famous sayings, rather light a candle than complain about darkness. If you can do something, do it. If there's nothing to do, do nothing, but don't worry about it. How often is it that when people in that situation, they've got nothing, they're in a problem, they think, there's nothing they can do about it, but they worry themselves silly. Now that is, I think, the time where we can put a bit of effort, a bit of wisdom, a bit of letting go. So we're in a situation with nothing we could do about it. At least we can be happy and be peaceful. And just to let go, to not tether ourselves to the future. A few times I've been in that situation, you know, when you've been in trouble, you don't know what's going to happen next. You just don't worry about it. Something will happen, something will turn up, and it often does. That's why, you know, that saying, if you're ever sick, dying in hospital, you don't have to worry about anything. You'll either get better or you'll die. Either way, the sickness doesn't last. And you die, so what? You get reborn again, have another body, give it another chance. Why do people just get so tethered, you know, just to having it this way and not the other way? So when we learn how to let go of these things, we don't worry about much. As I've been saying in many of the meditation talks I've been given over the last year, when you look at it rationally, clearly, if you are really concerned about what's going to happen next in the future, where is the future born? Where is it generated? Now. So if you are concerned about what's going to happen next, put more attention into what you're doing now. This is where the future is born, right now. So we care about the future by being in the present, by untethering ourselves to this worry business and that we can get the best possible future. That's also why that great piece of research I mentioned many times, United States sociologists did a huge amount of research and found the best way to be successful is to be happy first. Happy people are successful. So if you want to be successful in life, create happiness. And where can you create happiness? Now. Well, that reminds me. Because I usually tell a joke, and I haven't told a joke the last couple of times. To be happy, here is today's joke. And this is courtesy of Burr, who was at our monastery, who told me a nice religious joke. This man went to the hospital for an operation. It was a very nice hospital, a Catholic hospital, as many of the great hospitals here in Perth are run by the Catholics. And after the operation was successful, and when he got his bill, he had a bit of trouble. So he went to the accounts department. There was one of the nuns there was working in the accounts, one of the Catholic nuns, and he said, "Look, I'm terribly sorry, I can't pay this account, can't pay the bill." And she said, "Well, haven't you got any family, like a wife or a parent?" He said, "No, I've got no family at all. Sort of only a sister, but, you know, she's a nun. She's like a spinster, like you." And the nun said, "Catholic nuns, we're not spinsters. We're married to Jesus." And this man, who couldn't pay his bill, said, "Does that mean that my sister is married to Jesus too, because she's a Catholic nun?" "Yes," said the nun, "your sister is married to Jesus too." "Oh," said this man, "you can send the bill to my brother-in-law then." So that's today's joke to make you happy. And unfortunately, many times when I give these talks, that's all you remember. A joke. But anyway, getting back to the meaning of life and not tethering ourselves to things is when you can learn how to let go of the past, again, you're much more free. And that's an important part which we do in Buddhism, especially in meditation. So we can get more meaning. And by developing positive qualities in this moment, like kindness, you know, to your family, giving them time, even though you think that the future is going to be terrible if you don't sort of get that work or that assignment in or that sort of work done in time by the time you get to the office, you know, on Monday morning. Your family are much more important. Please remember that. Your health is very important. So you get sort of the contract signed, but at the expense of a cancer or high blood pressure. Is that really worth it? Or you have some terrible thing happen to you in life, you know, sort of a divorce, a loss of a loved one, or you've been cheated and abused and got into big trouble in the courts because of something you never did. Is that a reason to stop yourself being happy now? It's wonderful how we can learn how to untether ourselves from the past in the same way that you've seen children playing in the playground, having an argument and fighting. But once they have that argument, that little battle, 5 minutes later, 5 minutes later, they haven't got an enemy for life. They're playing together as friends again. How do they do that? Wouldn't it be wonderful if we can teach our leaders the wisdom of children playing in the playground? So we can have our arguments. Arguments are natural. We can have our friendship, which is greater than those arguments. The friendship, the harmony, the peace is more important than carrying around the past, carrying around the argument, who's right, who's wrong, who did what. Perhaps I had a fortunate childhood. My father and mother used to argue, and sometimes they wouldn't speak to each other, maybe for a couple of hours. But then they'd always make up in front of myself and my brother. And that's my memory of my childhood. My parents were human beings. They did argue. But after a while, and it was usually actually my father would make the first move and make up with my mother. And they kiss and say sorry. always in front of the children. So what I learned from that was arguments happen. Two different people seeing things in a different way. But what's most important was seeing the resolution happen. And the resolution was never to say who was right and who was wrong. The resolution was say, let's put it behind us. Our love, our family, our peace are more important. Priorities were in the right place. It was only for 2 hours they forgot the priorities and argued with each other. Children in a playground, they have their priorities right. Friendship is more important. Why do we make such a big deal about what happened in the past? Because we tether ourselves to the past. We tether ourselves to our history, where we come from, what our religion is, what our race is, what our allegiance to what particular footy team is, and how many times we create suffering for ourselves that way. Wouldn't it be best to support the team on the top of the ladder every week? Why is it just because you're from Perth you can't support Essendon or whatever? I don't know. Who's on the top of the ladder now? Yeah, why can't you support Geelong? You have much more happiness. You always support the team on the top of the ladder and you always win the grand final every year. We like tethering ourselves. And I think that's one of the problems. In Buddhism, we call that the teaching of anatta. Tethering our sense of self to our past, to our religion, to our race, to our football teams, to our qualifications, to our abilities. And that sort of tethering ourselves to things, it does give us a solid sense of self, but that gives us a solid sense of suffering as well. And the opposite of what I've been talking about this evening is basic Buddhist detachment, learning how to let go, learning how to flow more, learning how to be like that balloon. You can flow through the sky, never feeling the force of the wind. Just being a one with the flow of things and not lingering. Otherwise, how many of you have moved from overseas? And do you really miss your friends back home? I remember a fellow who, one of the supporters early, he was a Thai man, and coming to live here in Australia, he missed Thailand so much, he was always homesick. So he went back to Thailand, and as soon as he landed in Bangkok, he missed Australia so much. And he was one of these ping-pong immigrants, always moving backwards and forwards, because whichever place he was always homesick. And it's a silly thing to be. Instead of being homesick, you should be like me. Just whenever you go, you're back with your friends. So instead of being missing one place, it's being wonderful. You're in this place with all the family here. When you go back to where you were born, then you've got all your friends and family there. You can get the best of both worlds. What a wonderful thing to do. When you're not tethered anywhere, you can enjoy where you are. You're never looking backwards, you're never looking forward, you're looking where you are and enjoying this moment. This is the only place where you can find peace and happiness and fulfillment, liberation, success, now. So that way that a person never looks back, never looks forward, enjoys where they are, has a more free mind, untethered, unattached, not lingering, not rushing forward, enjoying this moment, wherever you are, whatever you happen to be, putting as much effort into it as you can. When there's something to do, you give it everything you've got. There's nothing to do, you can rest and leave it alone. And make the priorities right in life. What's really important for you in life? What's the most important? Please focus on that. Then you understand it's not procrastination. You're just something is more important than getting these things done. Something is more vital than getting the dishes done, or because you have this life, you have this day, make use of it, enjoy it, make peace. I know Buddhism sometimes is seem to be like too soft and too slow and too letting go, but I think it's a balance we need in today's world. Maybe that's one of the reasons why it's becoming very popular, because we're so stressed out, we're so high achievers, and maybe we need the balance of Buddhism to bring us into line. So we can still achieve a lot in life. You only have to see how hard we work at Serpentine and how hard we work here and at Gijigana, what beautiful monasteries we're building, to see that we're not lazy as Buddhists. We can work hard and then we can just rest and not carry our burdens around. Whenever I go anywhere, next week I'll be in Sydney. This is just during the week, I'll be back here next Friday to give the talk. Whenever I go overseas, I never carry my monastery with me. You're only allowed 20 kilograms. And that'd be far too much of a bird to carry around. And Lord, I carry you guys around as well. That's wonderful. Wherever you are, there you are, and you don't carry the other place with you. What a beautiful life that is. We can just be. Enjoy this moment. Just giving a talk without any plan of what you're going to talk about. And as soon as it's finished, forget it all. Except for the joke, which I hope you enjoyed. So that's a talk about procrastination, the meaning of life, letting go of the past. What was the other one? Sorry? Euthanasia. I forgot about the dog business. So, because I mentioned that, I better sort of say something about it. It's something I mentioned many times before. For those of you who haven't heard it, if you know there is a dog or a cat, someone who is sick and ill, please ask the dog whether it wants to go. Actually, I got a letter from somebody about this recently, and their son was the vet or daughter was the vet, and they say very often that they are asked by the owner to inject the animal to kill it. And actually, they have no qualms about that because they look at that little cat or dog. And the cat and dog are very intelligent. They know what you're doing. And actually, they just lay their head in the vet's arms. And they even, if they're a cat, they lick the hand of the person killing it. Because they know that it's relieving their suffering. In those particular cases, I say, ask the dog or cat what it wants. Because if you're the owner of that animal and you've lived with it for a long time, all you need to do is to make your mind peaceful and calm, quiet, still. Even if you haven't meditated before, you can do that. And listen, ask the question, have you had enough? Do you want to go now? Or do you want to still live? And then feel what the answer is in your heart. Intuitively, don't think it, feel it. Whatever that answer is, which you feel, that's what you go with. I've had great success with that. This particular person says, yeah, they can understand just how practical that is and how often they can feel that cat, that dog, thanks you because it's had enough. Other times, the cat, the dog hasn't had enough. There's one of the ladies who comes here, she's not here today, but she told me that she had a dog, took it to the vet, had very bad cancer. Doctor said, got to put it down, no chance at all. She heard me say this piece of advice, she took that little dog to a corner and just asked it, do you want to die? And made her mind very calm. And she got the feeling back very clear, no, it didn't want to. So she told the vet, no, I'm sorry, I don't want to be put down. And against the vet's protestations about you being really cruel, uncompassionate, you're not really considering the animal's feelings, he said, yes, I am. So she took it home. The animal made a full recovery. And just the vet was just stunned. Because I'd never seen that before. As far as his vet's knowledge was concerned, it was an advanced cancer, could not survive. And this lady told me of her dog. Her husband was a peacekeeper in East Timor. And the dog considered it to be the protector of the family when he was away. Would always be, looking after the family. And as soon as he came home, they noticed the dog had some trouble in the eye, took it to the vet. It was riddled with cancer, and the vet couldn't understand why that dog was still alive. The dog was alive because it had to be, looking after the family. Well, the husband was in, I was in the army, was being a peacekeeper in East Timor. It's amazing, just the wisdom of animals. So, if that's your dog, or your cat, or whatever else it is, you take it to the vet, please ask it. It's the animal's call, not yours, to say it should live, it should die. Listen to it, and convey the animal's wishes to the vet. You don't kill it, you're just the conveyor of the message. So hopefully, that gives some practical, compassionate, wise advice on what to do with the animals under your sort of care, rather your friendship. And it gives much greater meaning to life. Okay, so that answers the doggy question, I hope. So I gave a complete talk today and I didn't procrastinate and leave off answering that question to another time. So I hope you enjoyed the talk tonight. Are there any questions or comments about this evening's talk? Any comments or questions about this evening's talk? Yes, always count on a question for Lawrence. It's you're saying about the differences in talks, which like monks like me give in the monastery to monks, or what I give here like on a Friday night to you wonderful people. I was going to say you riffraff, but I should say this. To you wonderful people. I can't be elitist. It's, you know, some time ago that some of you actually listened to these monk talks on a Wednesday night here. And you've commented they're different. But to be able to give those talks on a Wednesday night, I have to make sure there's just hardly any visitors coming to those talks. A few times on a Wednesday night, on a Friday night here, I said, I'm going to give a deep talk. But you know, you won't allow me to give one. By that I mean that when I give talks here, you know, I don't plan these talks. And I scan you when I'm giving these talks. Get a feel for where you're at, what type of talk is meaningful for you. And the talk is not just me giving the talk. You're involved in this talk. It's my relationship with you when I give these talks. And you can't, I tried it, but I just can't do it when there's maybe 300 people here. The monks, even the nuns, even on retreats, I can give deeper talks. Because people are focused much more deeper on meditation and on ending things. They allow me to give such talks. You don't. Now this is from giving talks for a long time. You feeling that it's not me giving a talk. It is a dialogue between us. And it's not, just not me, it's you as well. So that's actually being very honest there about how it works. That's why even like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, you know, even give like a talk at the Burswood. And it was, you know, it's an okay talk, but it's not very deep at all. Because that's the audience there. So, you know, you have to have the audience, the speaker. There's a relationship there and it's not in the speaker's power. You know, to give a deep talk or an ordinary talk, it has to be just how it comes because of the relationship between where the audience are at and where the speakers are. Wow, really stir people up now. One, two questions, then we have finish it. Yes. Okay, so you gave an example of bullying, and how does that fit in with the idea of like justice being natural? Should you just let bullying go because the karma's going to come back to the bully, or if they're a Christian, they're going to go to hell or whatever, get punished? Or should you just let it go? It's the thing about the justice is the person who is doing the wrong thing, the punishment part of it is unnecessary, but the protection of the person who's the victim, that is important. So you wouldn't be so much looking to punish the perpetrator of the bullying, but your main motivation, if that was me, was actually to protect that victim and future victims of the bullying. And so I'd be very proactive there, trying to sort of find strategies, but not punitive strategies of punishing the bully, but protective strategies. So that's how I think of the situation there. It's the same as bullies in the workplace. As people keep, it's not just in the school ground. Bullies in the workplace, bullies in the family, bullies in the Buddhist society. I hope there's not. Wherever there's a bully, you know, we try and sort of, cause it hurts, it harms others, and we want to sort of try and protect other people. So, yes, question, yeah. Okay, so procrastination and telling your children to grab the moment, do the best you can. You know that story I said about this, what's done is finished? The first time I told that here, many years ago, on Sunday, I got a very complaint. It was from a Sri Lankan parent. I don't know if they're still here now, but if they are, I'm sure they'll enjoy this. Because I told that story, you know, that, oh, just enjoy the moment. You know, what's done is finished, because otherwise you'll never get everything done. And they came on Sunday to complain because their son was going out on Saturday night to a party. Well, he's 16-year-old or something. And the father said to the son, have you finished your homework yet? You remember you promised to finish your homework before you go out to the party. And the son said, as Ajahn Brahm said, what's done is finished. See you tomorrow morning. I really got into trouble for that one. But yeah, I mean, it's not to grab the moment. It's actually, yeah, grab this moment, but how do you grab it? And, you know, what are you putting into this moment? What's really important in this moment? And priorities are important. You know, sometimes that priority is just to give yourself a bit of a break. And teach your children that as well. Otherwise, you just get some more stressed out people in this world. There's too many already. So teach them to be happy. They're growing up. They're young. I mean, kids need to go to parties. I saw this genetically, that children genetically are supposed to stay up late and get up late. They're not actually programmed to get up at 7, 8 o'clock in the morning. Which is why it's so hard to get them out of bed. You're fighting their genes. But you've got to do it, so. They've got to get out of bed to get to school. But nevertheless, you understand why. I mean, understand why. Or you can be more sort of accommodating. And more understanding, at least. And so, what was the pressure on kids? And surely that, you know, when they're young, they can at least enjoy their time, their childhood, have a good childhood they can remember. I just remember my childhood because there was not so much pressure those days. You had a great time sort of playing soccer with your friends and wandering around. The holidays were so long. Yeah, you did well. You worked hard, but you also played well as well. You enjoyed your childhood instead of spending so much time working and homework. Is that what you want for your kids? Because when they're happy and content, not stressed out, they don't get too many psychological problems. And when they're happy, they always become successful somewhere along the line. They don't all have to become doctors or veterinary surgeons or dentists. And if they don't do well at school, they can become bricklayers and plumbers, and they make far more money than if they went to university. So anyway, that's the sort of answer.
Supati ka no ka go a jo sa wa ka sa wa sa fa na ma.